The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, Orson Welles stars in the CBS presentation of Norman Corwin's 14 August, recognizing VJ Day and the victory in the Pacific on August 14, 1945. We'll also hear the beginnings of radio station KQW, which began broadcasting in 1909 in San Jose, California. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the golden age of radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, we'll hear about the early days of radio station KQW, which began broadcasting in 1909 in San Jose, California. Right now, Orson Welles stars in the CBS presentation of Norman Corwin's 14 August, recognizing VJ Day and the victory in the Pacific on August 14, 1945. As WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
This day is the father of great anniversaries. Men and saints shall picnic together on 14 August, down more years than you or I shall see. So say it tonight with saluting guns. Say it with roses. Say it with a hand clasp, a drink, a prayer. Say it any way you want, but say it! Say it!
Columbia Broadcasting System presents 14 August, a message for the day of victory by Norman Corwin, spoken by Orson Welles.
Congratulations for being alive and listening on this night. Millions didn't make it. They died before their time, and they are gone and gone. For the fascists got them. They are not here, but their acts are here. And they are to be saluted from the lips and from the heart before the conversation swings around to reconversion. Fire a cannon to their everlasting memory. God and uranium were on our side. The wrath of the atom fell like a commandment, and the very planet quivered with implications. Tokyo Rose was hung over from the news next day, and the emperor prayed to himself for succor. So sound the guns for Achilles, the atom, and the war workers, Newton and Galileo, Curie and Einstein, the Archangel Gabriel, and the community of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Ladies and gentlemen, the peoples have come a long way since we were tadpoles. Much has happened, and the upward path has been strewn with dinosaurs, tigers, Caesars, slave traders, and fascists, in spite of which, as you have heard on the radio tonight, the best in the way of flags, is flying over the once mighty lands of the enemy, and free men are being born on schedule. New free men, conceived December last, during a counteroffensive against their elders in the Ardennes, are tonight breathing and kicking and making fists, our heirs to victory. Whereas the saber-toothed tiger is nicely arranged with fish fossils in the museum, and Caesar is twice hacked to pieces by his countrymen, the second time strung up by the heels to cure. The trader in slaves cannot buy back his name from the contempt of the generations. And the Nazi is parted from his pomp and his Führer, pending announcement of the hanging day. The Jap, who never lost a war, has lost a world, learning at what cost to us all that crime does not pay. This too is worth a cheer. Tomorrow will be time enough for humility. Tonight, we count our trophies. The scuttled hulk of the proud Graf Spee, a lie from the mouth of Goebbels, nailed to the ground, a carpet chewed by Hitler, later disinfected in the flames of Berchtesgaden, the Luftwaffe in a journey in the British junkyard, hand clasps and bear hugs on the Elbe, footprints and gun tracks going from Berlin to Warsaw to Stalingrad to Warsaw to Berlin in 68 months. Bloodiest round trip in history. Pearl Harbor, repaid 1,000 times. August 14. To the gun turret. And the turret lathe, and both stand still, and their masters stop to wipe away the sweat of winning. 14 August, to the tractor in the wheat field, and the farmhand who heard the news from Washington on the local wavelength a few hours back. 14 August to the flag on Suribachi and to Colin Kelly's boy and Maya Levin's mother. The bones of the expendables of Corregidor stir imperceptibly on 14 August. 14 August, Chinese time, to the bridge at Mukden where the Japanese crossed over into war. Some 14 years ago, next month. 14 August, to the blood brothers of Stalingrad, their armies lately a burning wind across the plains of Manchuria. 14 August, to the mending wounds among the hospitals and to the barracks bags and to the bunks and flight decks of the fighting ladies. New homecoming. Now the dog tag exchanged for the name again. They will converge from outlandish zones of time, from secret somewheres known alone to postmasters, from lanes of oceans and from windy desert camps. The comrades will write letters to each other for a while, and then drop out of touch. The mess halls where the meals were on the house will be forgotten soon enough between Jim's diner and home cooking. Beaches without beachheads. Jobs without sergeants. The men who tilted guns of battleships and stoked them in epic battle will ride the level ferries of bay and river, and tank men will drive a powered lawnmower while their fathers watch. The pilot with many missions will do errands for some civilian company. And the bombardier who crushed a city in a blinding instant will help his wife dry dishes in the kitchen sink. But peace is no dull enterprise this time. It will be armed and vigilant, not languid and flabby. The degenerate years of rigged markets, apple selling on the corner and produce plowed under in the breadline, are old ghosts, well laid. What God and laboratory have wrought can serve those who have served. The agitated atom would rather build a city than destroy one, and the jet plane carry passengers to mild appointments. 14 August is 14 August to half 100 United Nations, the greatest of which have fought too well together, ever to fall apart. Listeners, on 14 August, 1945, size up the latest news bulletins against the morbid yesterdays of Warsaw and Pearl Harbor, fallen Paris and the Blitz on London. Weigh Potsdam against Munich carefully, removing from the balance the millions who shall walk no more. Sketch in the dates and happenings from textbooks and from memory and draw your own conclusions. Are we agreed that all is one? That the world's a single continent? That mountains made of faith are not to be moved? That freedom is an endless river, jealous of its tributaries, fertilizing the country through which it flows? Study our time. It will do us good. Effective 15 August. Peace. Its care and handling becomes our homework. Say it tonight, with saluting guns, with champagne, and with laughter. But also remember the fields beyond, and the names and faces beyond. It is worth noting and remembering that here in this August, the grass is hearty, the sky friendly, the wind in the windsock, birds are competitive, the hills of home are in their accustomed places, and all is accounted for. All is accounted for except the farmer's boy and the mill hand who live near the canal and the young men from the city block where the gutters fry in summer. One lies with an ocean across his chest at the bottom of an Arctic deep. Another sleeps with sand in his eyes, where he fell on a beach at Palau. The bones of the fishermen rest in clay, far from the rocks of Maine. And the miner's kid is under the ground of China. The cricket sings in the summer night. But the soda clerk says nothing. The fawn leaps in the wolf-proof wood. But the jungle roots twine the postman's feet. The turtle is young at 61, but the flyer is dead at 18. Remember them. Oh, when July comes round and the shimmer of noon excites the locusts, when the pretty girls bounce as they walk in the park, and the moth is in love with a 60-watt bulb, and the tar on the road is blistered. They've given their noons to their country. They've trusted their girls to you. They are face to face with an ally's earth for a bunch of tomorrows. Remember them. Oh, in the fall of the year, when frost airbrushes the withering leaf, and the silo is fat as a bearing woman, and the cleats in the backfield dig up gains to the praise of the stadium, when the number one goose says it's time to go, and the flock points a bee to the south. They've given their seed to 48 states, their football tickets to you. The shirt on their back is a worm-cut rag for silks and breads and bomblessness, for kids unplanned today who will play ghosts and tojo every Halloween. Remember them. Oh, in the sleeting months, when the sap stands cold in the veins of the tree, and the bottle of milk on the frozen doorstep raises its cap to the morning, when the skating girls eddy like snow on the rink, and the storm window hooked on the prairie farmhouse mutters in the gale out of Idaho. They've spilled their blood for the rights of men, for people the likes of me and you. And they ask that we do not fail them again in the days we are coming to.
You have been listening to 14 August, a message for the day of victory, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin and spoken by Orson Welles. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Ladies and gentlemen, if it's color you want, Hollywood has got it. This is Jimmy Matthews reporting from in front of the CBS Playhouse in Hollywood, just off the corner of Hollywood and Vine. And believe me, you can hear the horns, the traffic in the background. Hollywood is absolutely going mad. There's nothing, traffic hasn't moved out in front of our playhouse here for the last 5 minutes. We're crowded with soldiers, sailors, civilians, everybody is out here. And right here at my side is a representative of our armed forces. And what are your immediate plans? I know you must have some.
I want to get back in a nice tweed suit, very loud with a loud tie.
That's a wonderful ambition. I don't blame you a bit. And now let's move our microphone a little bit around here. And now here's another member of our armed forces, a soldier. What's your name?
Private Mort Werner.
Private Mort Werner. Mort, what are your plans?
Well, just as soon as I can, I'd like to get back in one of those tweed suits and go after one of those radio announcing jobs like you have.
Oh, you like this radio announcing job. Well, one of our reporters, Dave Bale, has been up at the corner of Hollywood and Vine where our microphone won't quite reach and seen some of the color up there. Dave, what have you got to report?
Well, it's New Year's Eve at Hollywood and Vine, as you can tell by the noise. And with me, I brought back a gentleman in an Australian uniform. Will you tell us your name, sir?
Sid Hanneman.
Sid Hanneman, what part of Australia are you from?
Come from Sydney.
And what are you doing over here in this country?
I think it's great that we're here today. We like it very much. We think we're very, very lucky to be here today. We think it's a great day.
Fine. Well, I know all of us do. Well, let's see. We've had an Australian, we've had a soldier and a sailor, and right back here through the crowd, I see a Marine. Come on up here, young man. What's your name?
Private Duke Stoner.
Where's your home, Duke?
Iowa City, Iowa.
Iowa City. Well, you're right among a lot of Iowans out here in California. Any of your relatives living out here?
Not to the best of my knowledge. They have a few spare wives.
I see. And where are you stationed?
Camp Pendleton.
Camp Pendleton. What are you going to do when you get out of the service?
Oh, what a life I'm going to lead.
What a life you're going to lead. All of that and lots of luck to you.
Dave, look.
Thanks,
over
Duke.
Here. There's a young Canadian soldier, much bedecked with lipstick.
With lipstick.
I am not a soldier. Please, please, please.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
All right, ask me a question.
Well, what are you, sir?
I'm an airman.
An airman?
Oh, there's a difference. Yes, indeed.
Thank you for telling us.
And much bedecked with lipstick, much celebration in the offing, I
very
see.
Very fancy red scarf.
I didn't know the red scarf was there. We all here now. I didn't know the red scarf was there. Somebody draped it around me, but I love the kissing, and I'm looking for lipstick impressions as souvenirs to the place.
Oh. Wonderful idea.
I'm doing very well. I'm doing very well. I have, I mean, there's more girls here who are willing to kiss promiscuously.
Hollywood and Vine is a place to get...
To get kissed promiscuously.
Civil War men, well, right back here, sir. What are your sentiments on this day?
I was in 17.
It's now that the Japs have given up, it were time that Franco gave up, too, and gave freedom to Spanish people.
Well, thank you very much, sir. We're getting sentiments from all sides here.
Dave, did you see that car that just went by? About 30 people piled on top of a convertible just a few minutes ago.
Well, we're just about in time to pick up a band that's coming up the street here. A nice fat
Army
parade.
Band marching up the street.
Right, but I know that our CBS reporter in San Francisco, Don Mosley, is waiting. So this has been Dave Vail and Jimmy Matthews reporting from in front of the CBS Playhouse at Hollywood and Vine in the heart of the nation's film capital. We take you now to San Francisco, Don Mosley reporting.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio. Duke Ellington and the Harlem Footwarmers with Ring Them Bells from 1930. Jimmy Matthews reported for CBS Radio on VJ Day, the victory in the Pacific on August 14, 1945, and we also enjoyed Orson Welles reading Norman Corwin's 14 August. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY, at 90.3 FM.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now, we'll hear about the early days of radio station KQW, which began broadcasting in 1909 in San Jose, California. Narrated by Ken Ackerman and featuring Herb Ellis, Dick Ellers, and Jack Webb in this broadcast from November 10th, 1945, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
This week, across the nation, the radio industry celebrates its 25th anniversary of broadcasting. This, then, the story of KQW in the days of its early development, is the unique story of one man, Charles D. Harold. All facts presented in this program, which throws several new lights on the already interesting history of broadcasting, are based on carefully authenticated documents, interviews, and newspaper files. The story of KQW, as we begin by turning time back before the beginning of this century. 1897. From his platform in Stanford University, a professor lectures to the class in senior physics.
A useless dream. There are indications that sound may be transmitted without the use of wires, but learned men know its only value would be that of a toy. On the other hand, experiments at conveying music for many miles distant by telephone have been astonishingly successful. Think of it, gentlemen. We may yet live to see, or should I say hear, music carried to all the homes in the land by undreamed of telephone sets. Well, are there any questions?
Professor.
Yes, Mr.
Harold.
You have a question, Mr. Harold.
Well, if a sound could be transmitted without wires, Professor, like code, I mean, that is...
What else but code do you think could be transmitted without wires, Mr. Harold?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Then why can't the human voice be transmitted, too?
Oh, that's fantastic. The question of a dreamer, I'm sorry to say. My young man, evidently you've been asleep during my recent lectures. You've overshot the scientific intent of the wireless, my boy, as well as its basic principle. After some of its present difficulties are solved, the gadget may be put to a useful purpose. In fact, I dare differ with my colleagues in predicting that the wireless may come to be useful as a supplement to the cable. If you please, class, I shouldn't want to be repeated on that rash statement. No notes, please.
Only as a supplement to the cable, Professor?
Well, Mr. Harold again. What would you like to suggest this time? That the very noisy and inadequate wireless might be made to transmit music as well as the human voice?
You know, I've been wondering about that.
The transmission of code. No dream today, nor was it at the beginning of this century. For the early experiments with the wireless were with code, and so were its first practical uses. But to transmit any sound other than code was beyond the consideration of scientists.
Today, as a result of broadcasting, more music has already been played in actual amount of time than the world had ever heard before. The greatest of masterpieces enter the humblest of homes. A public service of radio that's as free as the air.
But the scientists at the turn of the century were right as far as they went. At that early date, it was impossible to produce the sustained carrier wave radio requires for the transmission of music and voice. Many scientists worked on the problem, separately in their scattered laboratories, together in the common purpose. And then, in 1907, one of these men accomplished the impossible.
Doc, here's something in that New York paper.
Can't you wait? I'm having trouble setting this crystal.
But here's an item about the wireless. I thought you'd be interested.
Oh, let's see. Where?
It's kind of hard to find. There's no headline. Way down there in the fourth page, see?
Oh, yes, about Dr. Lee DeForest and his transmission of... George, why didn't you tell me sooner?
I just happened to run across it, and it's a wonder, only two lines.
Two lines, and it's history. It's transmitted music. I knew it could be done.
Now, take it easy, Doc.
It's here. It's really been done. Now we're going to see the beginning of something so big, I'm going to be a part of it.
Sure, Doc, but don't get hot under the celluloid. This Lee DeForest beat you to it.
I see you haven't gotten the idea. In science, a thing like this, we aren't running a race. We're all together, piling more facts on more facts until... Who knows? Maybe the air will be filled with music.
There you go, dreaming again.
This is quite an old paper. It's been several months since Madame Geraldine Farrar sang over that transmitter. Wonder if her voice was sustained in the ether waves. I'll have to get in touch with Dr. Lee DeForest. Do you know, I have an idea. I could get a lot of help from a man like that.
1907, and the first demonstration of the transmission of the human voice and music was accomplished without wires. For that first broadcast was a song.
1945, 38 years later, at the beginning of this week, that same Dr. Lee DeForest appeared on the Columbia Network, introduced with pride as the father of broadcasting. His voice brought to all the nation by means of the miracle he first demonstrated, the transmission of the human voice without wires.
But that first experiment of broadcasting the human voice was soon forgotten by all but a few. And among the few was Charles D. Harold, who kept on remembering when he set up a new enterprise in San Jose in 1908.
The Harold Radio and Engineering College. That's a fancy shingle, Doc.
Think I'm hanging it high enough, George?
Well, looks just right where it is.
Well, here it goes, for better or worse.
Looks like you'll make a lot of mazuma out of this school, Doc.
I'll need to.
That's what I say, and spend it while you can.
Some of my ideas are going to cost a lot of money.
Now, Doc, you ain't going to start that again. Look, from where I hear, you'll get a couple of hundred students signed up. Why, you can retire, lead a life of ease at Coney or some other classy place.
No, George. We all have our desires, and money isn't mine. I don't suppose I'll ever be rich, the way you think of it, or most people.
What other way is there?
I guess it's a case of what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Take that experiment of Dr. Lee DeForest now. It was a great thing, but there's more to it. I don't suppose I'll ever be satisfied until I've proved to myself whether I can make good on some of the hunches about that.
There go your profits.
Well, this isn't getting the school started. I can hardly wait for the first class. Something tells me I'll begin with an experimental lab session.
Ah, free help.
Well, I'll get a lot of technical assistance that way. And if I'm able to do what I think I can, I'm going to need them.
1908, with a demonstration of voice broadcasting already successful the year before, and the ether waves still containing only the occasional transmission of code.
The beginning of 1909. Still no voices in the air, no music, only code. Then something happened in an inconspicuous school in San Jose, the Harold Radio and Engineering College.
Well, I don't know what to do. Get me all this wire.
All right, let's go to work.
Hey, look, here, stop.
You tell us, boss, huh?
What are we going to do with all this wire?
One at a time, please. Now, you've all seen the theory behind this demonstrated on the blackboard.
Well, how do we know it's going to work?
Bill's right. Why should we go to all this trouble when maybe the gadget won't work?
That's what I
well,
say.
It's like
I
this. Like in science, and radio is certainly a vital part of the science of physics.
Yeah. You know that.
Well, as I was saying, scientists don't expect their experiments to work.
They don't.
Pulling our legs, doctor.
No, I'm very serious. Serious. The true scientist expects every experiment to fail, except the last one.
Hey, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Let's go. Wait till I tell Mabel.
Yeah,
but Doc, hey, Doc, there's an awful lot of work to this. If you don't expect it to
work... Well, just between all of us and the gatepost, I believe I've already had the last experiment.
You mean you've already tried out this aerial?
On a small scale, and I'm convinced it's practical.
Well, if you say so, Doc, what are we waiting for?
Yeah. All right. Now for the manual labor. Now, first, we have to run up these wires to the top of those buildings.
All this wire?
Hey, I'll bet there's a mile of wire here.
More than that. According to my calculations, this carpet aerial requires 11,500 feet of wire.
And we have to get all of that seven stories up in the air?
Uh-huh. You'll have to be suspended between these two buildings. Hey, Pat, what seems to be your trouble?
Well, I got so dizzy looking at the tall buildings, I got tangled up.
Hey, Pat, the car.
When we get that much wire up, they ought to be able to hear us clear over to Palo Alto.
Oh,
yeah. Other than that, I certainly hope. San Francisco, at the very least.
Not 50 whole miles.
Hey, what are you giving us, Doc?
Even farther than San Francisco, if we're successful at all. Much farther. All right, men, let's hoist it up.
Let's go.
Get the wire. I don't know what to do. I'll try
to get it up. Spring of 1909, and although there's been music in the air for one brief moment 2 years before, there's still no music continuing on the ether. It's still code. Until something different is transmitted from the Garden City Bank building in San Jose and carried across space to San Francisco.
Hey, that voice is coming all the way from San Jose.
Are you sure you got the call right?
Sure. Here's the call. I copied it down.
Let me see. This is the wireless telephone from the Garden City Bank building in San Jose, California. Well, Doc Harrell's done it.
Man, I wish we could answer that call.
Oh, fine chance we'd have of getting through without his fancy rig for an aerial.
Well, why should we keep on riding a horse when it looks like the horseless carriage is here to stay? I'm gonna write to Doc and ask him how he does it.
Spring of 1909, and Charles Harrell's experimental maze of suspended wires for running the powerful vertical antenna of a generation beyond has proved its worth. There had been other instances of transmission over longer distances, but the event was a milestone in the development of Charles Harrell's pioneer broadcasting station. For now, he had transmitted voice more than 50 miles.
On to November 18, 1913, when a code message was being received. Said code.
Funny, I can't get any code on that wavelength.
Well, switch to something else.
I was getting something all the way from San Jose a minute ago, too.
That's some distance. I think we can hear him clear up here in Bremerton.
Hey, that's 1,000 miles.
Better not switch off.
I won't. Maybe this music will get off.
Did you say music?
Oh, my gosh. I said music. It's music.
Let me have those earphones.
No, you don't. Here, I'll tilt this one so we can both listen.
Did you hear it?
Yeah, just before it stopped. This is sensational. I hope the code confirms it.
This is the wireless telephone on the Garden City Bank building in San Jose, California.
No code.
Well, who wants code?
It was a voice.
That voice traveled 1,000 miles.
Man alive. I hope he brings us some more music and keeps on talking. I'd like to hear that fella keep up a regular line of chatter. Sure would help to pass the time.
Well, it's getting so we can't depend on these airwaves at all. Expect code and you get a voice, even music.
Something really new had been added to radio. Entertainment. On the air for more than just a few brief moments. And they heard Charles Harrell, his voice and his gramophone records over long distances across the sea, as far north as Bremerton, Washington.
You there, glued to the earphones. Would you mind repeating what you just said?
Well, like I was saying, I hope that fella keeps up a regular line of chatter. Sure would help to pass the time.
Well, now, I think I'll tell you about the weather.
Passing the time of day by means of the wireless. Who'd ever thought of such an outlandish idea?
Outlandish then, but today, in 1945, the world of radio means the world of entertainment. The greatest show on earth comes to you by radio.
In his studio laboratory, Charles Harrell worked to solve the difficulties that stood in the way of presenting radio entertainment.
All right, Ray. I think I've got this other microphone ready to go.
They burn out on us fast enough.
Oh, we'll get that licked. Well, let's get the air busy again.
Mm-hmm. Should be about ready to go, Doc. It didn't give it time to cool off much.
I can't help it, Ray. There's something about this idea of broadcasting regular programs. Well, I just can't get rid of the idea that there's something to it, that's all.
That was in 1912, the year Charles Harrell first began regular broadcasts from his station. The same broadcasting station that is now known as
KQW.
Station KQW, on the air since 1909. And in 1912, KQW became the first station in all the world to present regular programs.
That means KQW has been on the air since 1909, for 36 years. Yet this occasion we're observing tonight is the official 25th anniversary of radio.
That means this radio station began broadcasting 11 years, 11 full years before commercial radio was born. Began regular programs 8 years before the official birth of radio.
And this station has been on the air continuously ever since 1909?
No, for in the early days, there were intensive technical difficulties.
It's the microphones, Doc. They keep burning up.
We'll have to find a better method.
All right, let's switch her back on.
On the air, off again. Back on, back off the air again, and on again. Broadcasting engineers of the present era, accustomed to the finest equipment modern science has devised, would laugh if they could have seen the crude, homemade equipment that kept the forerunner of KQW on the air. They'd laugh if they could have seen Charles Harold sit down at his conglomerate equipment. But if they could have seen him when he started to play at the business of presenting programs, they'd marvel. For crude as were his implements, Charles Harold knew the basic principles of broadcasting. And what he didn't know, he knew that he didn't know and worked tirelessly to solve. And while he worked, he kept on broadcasting. And people began talking.
All of them wires strung over them buildings. My, my.
All that time he's a-wasting. Well, I suppose his students get some good out of doing something, even if what they're doing ain't good for nothing.
And there were others who had a few words to say.
Doesn't seem so bad being bedridden now. I used to think that there wasn't any brightness left in the world. But now there's Doc Harold bringing me music. Why, it's the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me.
Yes, Charles Harold continued to work on equipment while he kept on bringing the world its first radio programs. Then, in 1912, this radio station entered a new era and set a bold new pattern for the tremendous broadcasting industry that was to follow 8 years later.
Have you got the microphones?
Yes, I've got them, and they're connected.
Funny, they don't look the same, Doc, hooked up like that.
I know, Ray, but they're just as sturdy as in the lab.
Think four of them will be enough.
Well, we'll see.
It's a great theory, Doc. Absolutely great. Water-cooled microphones.
We'll see if they work. And if they don't, well, we'll still have that last experiment to look forward to. You know, the one that works.
That'll be this one.
Looks like the solution. As long as we've been burning out the old ones so fast...
Yeah. If we just didn't have to tie the microphones right into the antenna circuit. Well, these water-cooled mics will do the trick.
Throw on the switch.
Mm-hmm.
If they work, we'll be able to maintain continuous broadcasting. Why, if these new microphones just hold up, we can keep the programs going from 6 to 8 hours without interruption.
Here she goes.
Now we'll see.
It works. The ingenious device of resisting heat in microphones with water succeeded. From 1912 on, except during the years of the First World War, when Charles Harold was engaged in radio war work, this radio station, even in those pioneer days, was on the air regularly.
In 1912, too, this radio station established another first.
Hello, San Francisco. Come in, San Francisco.
Hello, Doc Harold. This is the station in the Fairmont Hotel, San Francisco.
You've done it. Shh, excellent. The contact is established. Ladies and gentlemen of Radioland, you are about to hear the first two-way broadcast. And we're bringing you this entertainment from San Francisco and San Jose. Will you accept the honor of playing the first musical selection, Fairmont Hotel?
Doctor, the pleasure's mine. For your first selection, you will hear In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree.
Another record, the first two-way voice communication blended into a radio program. A record of small importance today, but a milestone in radio history. And the water-cooled microphones invented by Charles Harold succeeded in keeping the air lanes hot from 6 to 8 broadcasting hours a day on through 1913, 1914, and 15.
Curious that it was a scientist who first insisted that the wireless should be used for entertainment. For the rest of the scientists, as well as the businessmen, were saying,
this wireless telephone, it isn't really so effective for communication. Why, there's nothing private about it. Anybody can tune in the messages. Too bad it will never be anything but a toy.
But there was one other exception. Listen to these words from a letter highly valued in the history of broadcasting.
I have in mind a plan of development
which would make radio a household utility in the same sense as the piano or phonograph. The idea is to bring music into the home by wireless.
David Sarnoff, later to become the head of RCA, wrote those words. He was considered ahead of his time. Yet he wrote that letter in 1916, 7 years after this radio station began presenting programs, 4 years after this radio station began regular broadcast service.
Yes, there were those who, even in the very early days, thought the wireless was here to stay. And in 1915, Charles Herold was given his chance to prove it.
Oh, well, this is a surprise. Inspector Stone.
No, don't be formal, Doc, please.
After all, a call from the United States Radio Inspector.
Well, this is hardly official. The fact is, I'm here because of the Panama Pacific International Exposition.
Oh, yes, I hear they're all excited in San Francisco. How are the exhibits coming?
Well, now that, Doc, is what I was sent to see you about.
An invitation, an honor, a command performance, a request to broadcast programs for the Panama Pacific International Exposition. The KQW of Knee Pants was going on review.
Sounds like somebody had built a better mousetrap.
And the world had asked for a demonstration.
The Panama Pacific Exposition of 1915. All the world milling through San Francisco. And most of the crowd stopping before the booth that was demonstrating the wireless.
I'm going back to the Midway.
Now wait. What's this? Oh, it's an exhibit of the wireless.
Well, from everything I've heard, it's here to stay. And Fatima isn't. Come on, let's go.
Come on! Come on! I've always wanted to see how this gadget works.
Well, there's the gramophone.
No, it's the wireless.
Don't be foolish. There's the gramophone horn.
But where's the disc? Tell me that.
It's all done with mirrors. You know how these things are.
Listen.
We're playing for the exposition, folks. So here's the latest music on a cylinder. When you wore a tulip, a big yellow tulip, and I wore a big red rose.
It talks, didn't I tell you? It's Doc Harold's wireless program.
Kind of haunted.
Well, if you'd rather see Fatima...
No, no, she can wait.
And so, in 1915, multitudes finally saw and heard that marvelous new invention called the wireless. The demonstration booth at the Panama Pacific Exposition was conducted by Dr. Lee DeForest. And the programs he demonstrated to the crowd were transmitted by Charles Herold.
So it was the two men, one to be known forever as the father of radio, and the other as the first broadcaster, worked together in giving the world its first major demonstration of radio entertainment.
Yes, those who came to the Panama Pacific Exposition heard at last the music that had been brought to the air, and they heard voices in the air, too.
This is the wireless telephone on the Garden City Bank building in San Jose, California.
So, through the years, this radio station has grown, beginning with the world's first radio programs in 1909, advancing with the world's first regular programming in 1912, continuing to develop its programs and public service beyond the wildest dreams of its founder.
Then, step by step, the radio industry progressed.
August 20th, 1920.
Station 8MK, Detroit, now WWJ, begins daily operation.
November 2nd, 1920.
KDKA, Pittsburgh, begins broadcasting regular schedule of programs with the Harding Cox election returns.
July 2nd, 1921.
First sports broadcast, the Dempsey-Carpenter fight in Jersey City.
September 7th, 1922.
Station WEAF in New York broadcasts the first commercially sponsored program.
1923.
President Harding speaks from St. Louis over a three-station network.
1924.
The first broadcast of the National Political Conventions over nationwide networks.
1926.
The National Broadcasting Company is organized.
September 18th. 1927.
The Columbia Broadcasting System on the air with 16 stations.
1928.
Herbert Hoover officially notified of his nomination for presidency. His acceptance speech broadcast over a 107-station network from Palo Alto.
1931.
First broadcast of a complete operatic performance from the Metropolitan in New York.
March 12th,
1933, President Roosevelt broadcasts the first of his fireside chats. December 7th, 1941, radio flashes the first news of the Japs' sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. And in the war years that followed, radio developed tremendous worldwide shortwave networks that enabled the people at home to follow the course of the war in a manner hitherto unknown.
Today, November 10th, 1945,
the world at peace, and radio dedicated to the ideal of worldwide peace through closer cultural ties with all the peoples of the world.
And so, as this week concludes the official observation of broadcasting's 25th anniversary, this radio station, a pioneer by more than a decade ahead of radio's official birth, salutes all pioneer radio stations. Salutes with particular pride its founder, who is still living today, the first man to bring regular programs to radio, Charles D. Herold.
We now present a message by Dr. Charles D. Herold, transcribed this afternoon at his home in the Piedmont Hills, returning his voice to the same station he founded so many years ago.
I'm gratified and happy to speak to you on this occasion. Station KQW has gone far beyond my dreams. I'm particularly proud that the dream we had for radio as an entertainment medium has materialized. Radio has indeed outgrown its infant clothes. I am happy to have been the first man to broadcast radio entertainment on a regular schedule.
The story of KQW has been written and produced by Roy Grandy. The associate director was Don Victor. The cast included Dick Ellers, Herb Ellis, Dick Dwyer, and Jack Webb. Sound effects by Don Creed, engineering Paul Smith. Your announcers have been
Clarence Cassell
and Ken Ackerman.
All material presented on this program is from carefully authenticated documents, interviews, and newspaper files. This, the story of KQW, is dedicated to Charles D. Herold, the man who developed the world's first radio station to present regular broadcasts, and saw it grow until today we are able to say,
this is KQW San Jose, the Columbia station for San Francisco, Oakland, and the Bay Area.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, narrated by Ken Ackerman. The story of KQW, first broadcast on radio on November 10th, 1945. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.